The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with an interesting fact. This is why the British drink so much tea. Making tea is the British response to every situation, from birthdays to bad news. But how did this small island come to drink so much tea? And if you ever watch any of the programs that happen to be on Acorn TV, where they're all British or Australian, every time something happens, they bring out the tea. In America, tea has two primary associations: iced, served on the southern porch on a sweltering day, or salty, given some fish a caffeine boost at the bottom of Boston Harbor. In Britain, however, tea is inextricably woven into the fabric of everyday life. The proof is in the numbers. The British drink 100 million cups of tea every day. That's almost 36 billion cups per year. Divided amongst British men, women, and children, that's right, they start them young over there. For contrast, only about 70 million cups of coffee are drunk daily in Britain, and we bet they don't call it Cup of Joe either. Tea for every occasion. Many Brits firmly believe that no task, from study to data entry to putting up a shelf, could be accomplished without a good cuppa. Some even measure the length of a task by how many cups of tea are required to finish it. Painting a wall might take 3 cups, say, while researching for your thesis could be 5+. Tea is the default response to a myriad of situations. Waking up, shocking news, returning from a boozy night out, good news, breaking up, giving birth, meeting a friend, feeling uncomfortable, or feeling happy. How you take your tea indicates your social class, personality, and tribal affiliation. Make tea. That's what Brits do instead of panicking. But the country that consumes the most tea annually is Turkey. Tea isn't even from Britain. So what gives? The history of tea drinking. In 1946, George Orwell wrote in the Evening Standard, "Tea is one of the mainstays of civilization in this country." Tea had been such for nearly 300 years, ever since Catherine of Braganza arrived from Portugal and married King Charles II, bringing with her a ritual of daily tea time. The other normals followed suit, and the British East India Company began to import much more tea from its colonies in the Far East, where it had been grown and drunk for thousands of years. The price fell, and suddenly every Briton had a tea habit. Tea is one of the few experiences in Britain that cuts across social class divides, race, ethnicity, and income levels. The other is the weather. It also gives socially awkward Brits something to do with their hands. After centuries of ritual, the British identity is now at least 10% tea. But most cultures that drink tea, such as China, India, and Turkey, don't add milk. So why do the British? Milk plays an important role. Tea is traditionally brewed in a pot and poured out in individual cups. Most people, however, could not afford fine-bone china, and the cups they did have would may often shatter under the heat of the boiling tea. Milk was therefore added first to the cups to lessen the heat of the hot tea and keep the cups intact. Many people apparently grew to like the taste, although some take their tea with sugar or lemon instead. In modern times, the milk-first issue is a hot topic. Friendships have been lost over whether it's correct to add milk to your cup before tea or after. But history and science both say before. Scientists note that cold milk poured into hot tea heats unevenly and can give tea that awful skin on top. But so does social class. British anthropologist Kate Fox, author of Watching the English, notes that milk and tea also gives all social cues to Britain's all-important social class system. According to Fox, tea strength wanes as the social class gets nearer to the aristocracy. The strongest brews of black tea are drunk by the working class, who are then required to temper the bitter taste with plenty of milk and sugar to make builder's tea. Taking sugar in your tea is regarded by many as an infallible lower-class indicator, Fox writes. So there you have it. Tea communicates a lot from social standing to emotional state, which is useful for the British, who tend to be suspicious of emotional displays. Best to just have a nice cup of tea instead. And here's another interesting fact. Why women's and men's shirts button from different size? I wonder if you've noticed that. Women's shirts have buttons on the left, while men's have them on the right. But it's not about which hand you write with. The button differential. Once upon a time, your gender determined your fashion choices. For the most of the last few hundred years in the Western world, women wore dresses and skirts and men wore pants, except for the Scots. Thankfully, fashion has evolved, and the Irish too. Thankfully, fashion has evolved such that both men and women are now free to wear anything they please, although it's still suggested to take fashion tips from personal stylists. There are a few gender trash trends that persist, however, and it's one that makes women dressing just a little more difficult than it needs to be. Buttons. Buttons appear on different sides of a shirt or jacket depending on which gender it was designed for. Despite the fact that the vast majority of all humans are right-handed, only men's shirts have buttons on the right side. Women's shirts have buttons on the left side. Great for lefties, but an extra couple of minutes in the morning for everyone else. It seems particularly absurd to given the relative similarity in the shape of men's and women's shirts. Sure, there might be a little extra tailoring to account for some generalized curves, but the humble button-up shirt is one of the more unisex items of clothing regularly worn by both sexes. A good shirt can help you dress to look younger. So why the button bewilderment? The origins of the opposite button debate has been lost over time, although historians do have theories. Back in the day, think 13th century, buttons for only those who could afford them. Everyone else simply tied their clothes with strips of cloth or fastened them with wooden toggles. As well as having clothes that buttoned, middle and upper class women also usually had maids to help them get into and out of their elaborate outfits. It's difficult to get into corsets, bustles, hoop skirts, and several layers of petticoats by yourself. Knowing that someone else would be doing the buttoning, dressmakers sewed the buttons onto the left side of women's garment to make it easier for the maid to do them up right-handed. Once clothes started being mass-produced, the custom became standardized, and no one has thought to change it to this day, including our need for stylish tops for Zoom calls. There are other theories, most notably regarding babies and horses. Again, as most women are right-handed, they tend to carry their wee ones with their left arms on their left hips. This frees up their right hand for answering the phone, putting the kettle on, and unbuttoning their shirt if still breastfeeding. With regard to horses, well, women started off riding side saddle, usually turned to the left side. Although this is almost certainly terrible news for your back and hips, shirts and jackets that button with the right flap over the left would let in less wind as you galloped along. But what about men? True, having considerably less constrictive outfits, they usually dress themselves. That may have contributed to the right button placket convention. But the real answer might go way, way, way back to the days of knights, jousting, and chivalry. Men's shirt buttons with the left flap over the right, which mimics one of the oldest conventions of battle, shield on the left arm, sword in the right. As your enemy's lance would have been on his right hand, armor plates overlap from left to right to keep that shield side doubly protected. Even as times changed and weaponry evolved, men's clothing retained echoes of military trappings and was often designed to include accommodations for swords and pistols. As these were mostly held in the right hand, it was advantageous to be able to button with the left. So there you have it. The thing is, there's absolutely no reason why this strange artifact of gender inequality should linger on to today's button garments. Lefties may disagree, but living in a world that respects right-hand dominance when it comes to coats, jackets, shirts would be another, if admittedly small, step toward gender equality. After all, the button differential has been used before to argue that women are physically inferior to men, needing help to dress themselves as they must. Why else would the buttons be on the left side? But short of switching to zippers, we might be stuck with button bewilderment for a few more years. Now, how about an article of food for thought? The hottest kitchen tip? Freezing. Our ability to make things extremely cold has granted us modern luxuries such as ice water, popsicles, and most important, a way to keep food from rotting. But there's more to freezing than meets the eye, and chefs and mixologists have been making magic with sub-zero temperatures for centuries. You can syro-blanch herbs, such as basil, for more flavored pepsil, syro-chuck bivalves, such as clams, which pots open as they thaw, and cryo, tenderized, notoriously tough seafood, such as octopus, thanks to ice crystals that make micro-tears throughout the meat. Freezing also makes it much easier to thinly slice meats and dice slippery pork fat. New York chef Lucas Sin has been popularizing long-held techniques from northeastern China that involve freezing different foods, including Asian pears, sweet potatoes, and tofu. The cold alters their texture, sweetness levels, and juiciness in interesting and delicious ways. Tofu becomes spongier and better absorbs the liquid it's cooked in. Asian pears become soft and juicy once the ice crystals defrost, taking on a poached texture while maintaining their fresh flavor. Sweet potatoes, which are roasted after freezing, come out sweeter and more caramelized. That's interesting. Ultra-cold temperatures are also the secret to making apple-baked liquors. Behold Applejack, a high-proof alcohol sold in stores that's seasonal and warming in this delicious hot toddy recipe, which I'll read later. Applejack is made from freezing hard cider and progressively removing more and more of the water as it ices over, leaving the alcohol behind. What left is a concentrated solution with a white boozy punch, similar to distillation but without the need for a still or a fire and the technical know-how that traditional evaporation-based methods requires. In a cold climate, you can leave your hard cider out in the wintertime, deep freeze, and jack it into something that resembles a spirit. If that's not the epitome of cool, we don't know what is. Applejack Hot Toddy. And there's a picture of an apple-shaped cup with a stem coming out of it and a slice of lemon in it. Stud, a 1-inch thick lemon wheel with 3 cloves. Fill a mix with boiling water to preheat. Discard water. Add 1 ounce of honey and 5 ounces of fresh boiling water to warm mug and stir until thoroughly combined. Stew in 2 ounces of Applejack, then add the prepared lemon wheel and 1 piece of star anise. Stir in fresh lemon juice, 1/2 teaspoon at a time, to taste. If desired, garnish with 1/2 vanilla bean pod, then serve. Sounds good, particularly on a cold day. All in a day's work. I feel so lucky to be a writer's assistant, but so unlucky that a room full of people have to watch me try to type the word lieutenant. It is a hard one to spell. The Healthy Wellness from thehealthy.com. When heart disease runs in the family, what you can do with the cardio cards you've been dealt. I had no idea what was going on, recalls Jenny Pets, mother of 2. She remembers thinking at the time, why is my mother sitting on my chest to talk to me? She knew that made no sense, but it was the only explanation she'd think of for the extreme chest pressure and heaviness she felt as she lay on the nursery floor in 2008, drifting in and out of consciousness. Later she learned that her mother was there, but she wasn't talking to Pets. She was on the phone with the 911 operator, summoning an ambulance. Pets, young, fit, and healthy, had given birth 8 days earlier. At age 32, she was having a heart attack. An EKG at the hospital revealed the severity of Pets' condition. Her heart attack had been caused by spontaneous coronary artery dissection, SCAD. It's as scary as it sounds, she says. One of the main arteries to my heart exploded. Another artery Pets' heart was 90% blocked, and when the pregnancy put extra strain on her heart, the clogged artery increased the work for the remaining arteries, and the increased pressure eventually became too much for the arteries. Pets was rushed into surgery, where doctors placed a stent in the blocked artery and repaired the one that had ruptured. She was lucky to be alive. Next came the search to figure out why someone who didn't appear to have risk factors for heart disease had suffered such a potentially cataclysmic event. The culprit, her cholesterol, which measured 317 mg/dL, far above the high-risk category. I'd never had my cholesterol tested because I'd never seen a reason to, she says. I had no obvious risk factors. A genetic test showed a familiar hypercholesterolemia, a life-threatening, by the way, that's about 23 letters, a life-threatening condition that leads to high cholesterol. A mutation means the body can't remove the LDL, low-density lipoprotein, or bad cholesterol, from the blood as it normally would. Heart attacks or strokes often follow. Family hypercholesterolemia affects about 1 in every 250 people. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, although many, like Pets, are never diagnosed until serious symptoms arise. Many people who are never diagnosed at all, their elevated cholesterol chalked up to bad lifestyle choices. Familial hypercholesterolemia is only one of the many heart conditions that can be passed down from parents to children, including cardiomyopathies, disease of the heart muscle, arrhythmias, irregular heartbeat, and more. Of course, lifestyle also plays a powerful role in determining heart health. Inactivity, obesity, and smoking contribute. According to the CDC, heart disease is the leading cause of death in America, where it's responsible for 1 death every 36 seconds. The risk for heart disease can increase even more when the heredity combines with unhealthy lifestyle choices, such as smoking cigarettes and eating an unhealthy diet, says Satjit Bushri, M.D., founder of Upper East Side Cardiology in New York City. Knowing your family history can help you assess your risk and take steps to lower them. The American Heart Association has a free downloadable My Family Health Tree PDF to make this easier to track. Make a systematic assessment of your health of your relatives. In addition to your parents, siblings, and kids, also remember your grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, nephews, and nieces, says Carolyn Young-Ho, MD, the medical director of the Cardiovascular Genetics Center and an associate professor of cardiology at Harvard Medical School in Boston. Make note of which side of the family you are talking about and any important medical illnesses, such as well as age and circumstances of how people passed away. Being organized can help you and your doctor identify important patterns, she says. Fortunately, even the most problematic genes can lie dormant in most people if they make a positive health habits a priority. A 2016 study in the New England Journal of Medicine reports that those with high genetic risk for heart disease had about double the risk for a heart attack or stroke, but they could trim their risk by a whopping 46% with healthy lifestyle choices, including not smoking, exercising regularly, eating a well-balanced diet, and maintaining a body mass index of less than 30. Try to reduce the risk that you control, Dr. Ho says. Being healthy and active is the best defense and offense. Jenny Pence, now 46, has done just that. After her terrifying heart attack, Pence went through cardiac rehabilitation and suffered no lasting heart damage. Oh, she was lucky there. She began taking a statin to lower her cholesterol and a drug to lower blood pressure. She does her best to exercise regularly and eat a healthy diet. Thanks to these changes, my total cholesterol has stayed around 150 milligrams / DLL, right in the healthy range for years now, says Pence. Had her two children tested for the genetic condition caused her heart attack, and fortunately, they did not inherit it, she said. So she's very lucky in that respect. How about some laughter, the best medicine? Grandpa always said, when one door closes, another one opens. Great band, horrible cabinet maker. Stop, drop, and roll. A beginner guide to bowling. For those of us who remember the atomic bomb age. Horror movie reboots for middle age. Dawn of the Dead, car battery. Stepchildren of the Corn. Rosemary's Baby Shower. The Last Co-op on the Left. Night Sweats of the Living Dead. Mortgage Payment of the Damned. Final Destination Wedding. Small Talk about remodeling the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Bridal Shower of Frankenstein. The Six Sensible Meal. The Baba Book Club. The Blair Witch School Project. At Wit's End, a long-running Reader's Digest section called Picturesque Speak featured wit from writers of the day. In celebration of her 100th year, here are a few favorites from the 1930s and 40s. He looked as if he had been poured into his clothes and had forgotten to say when. P.G. Woodhouse. Occasionally, he stumbled over the truth, but he always picked himself up and hurried on as if nothing had happened. Winston Churchill. That's funny. His idea of conversation is talking to himself in the presence of others. Donald Reins. He's a sci-fi writer. He looked at me like I was a side dish he hadn't ordered. Ring Lardner, humorist and novelist. He came from the shady side of the family tree. Joseph Mitchell, New York writer. The story was designed in a light vein that somehow became a varicose vein. Realization. The asteroid that ended the dinosaurs was technically the highest ratio of killing birds to one stone in Earth's history. Considering we're still in Black History Month in February, let's read a story about What Roots Means to Me from Alex Haley. Alex Haley's landmark book began in Reader's Digest, where he worked as a senior editor. The repercussions are still being felt today, and this is by Henry Louis Gates, Jr. If you watch PBS, you know he does a lot of stuff about ancestry. I first heard of Alex Haley sometime around 1967 when I was a student in high school. My brother Paul, who was a student at the School of Dentistry at West Virginia University, called to tell me that this man had given a dazzling lecture on campus. He was so excited that he wanted to share the experience with me. The lecture was part of a book the author would be publishing based on stories he had heard from his aunt. He was on the circuit, he told his audience, trying to raise enough money to complete it. It's one word, Paul said, of the book's title. I can't remember what the word is, but it's bad, man. You're going to eat this up. I said, well, what's the word? I can't remember, he said, but I'll remember. A couple days later, he called me back and said, it's Roots. I thought, oh, man, Roots. My mind began racing. Roots. What a brilliant title. I had been interested in my own roots since I was 9 years old when I interviewed my parents and drew up my first family tree. on the very day after we buried my father's father. So when I read Reader's Digest Experts of Roots in 1974, I was mesmerized. That's the only word for it. In 1977, the television adaptation premiered, and I became a big part of the biggest audience for a miniseries in the history of the medium at that time. Starting with that phone call from my big brother, I had a serious bout of envy toward Alex Haley. I wanted to be like him. I wanted to reverse the Middle Passage and find out where my ancestors were from in Africa, the motherland. Frederick Douglass, in his 1855 book, My Bondage and My Freedom, says genealogical trees do not flourish among slaves. In the first chapter of his slave narrative, published a decade earlier, he tells us twice within a few paragraphs of the whisper that his father was also his master. But he didn't know for sure, and that haunted him. One of the last train trips he'd made was to a descendant of his master to see if his master's records had any mention of his birth, because the other thing that haunted him was that he didn't know his birthday. Slaves, Douglass writes, could only approximate the dates of their birth with the cycles of the seasons. Planting time, harvest time, cherry time, spring time, or fall time, he tells us, that not knowing was a source of trauma and that it would remain so for the rest of Douglass's life. The fact that most fundamental genealogical information was systematically deprived from our people has, I think, produced an understandably inordinate compulsion among African Americans to find out not just from whence we descended in Africa, but details on our family tree on this side of the ocean. Alex Haley, writing in the pages of this magazine in May 1977, called it a hunger marrow deep to know our heritage, to know who we are and where we came from. By then, Roots had sold over 1 million copies in hardcover. With his phenomenally successful book, Alex Haley seemed to be answering Frederick Douglass, "No, Fred, genealogical trees do flourish under slavery. You just don't have to know how to look for them." My PBS series, Finding Your Roots, which I named in homage to the title of Alex Haley's book, can trace its own roots to that family tree I crafted with my parents' help back in July 1960, and to a letter I received 40 years later from a brilliant African-American geneticist named Dr. Rick Kittles. "Dear Dr. Gates," he wrote, "have you ever watched Alex Haley Roots? I thought, what kind of idiot does this guy think I am? Everybody's watched Roots." Dr. Kittles went on, explained that scientists can now do in a test tube in a laboratory what Alex Haley purported to do in Roots, and that we could trace an African American's African ethnic origins on his mother's mother's line or the father's father line through DNA. He was looking for volunteers, so I picked up the phone, called his laboratory, and said, "You got the right man." 3 years after Dr. Kittles tested my DNA, at that time they had to take blood. Now, of course, you just spit into a test tube. I got the idea for the show, which from the beginning was a huge hit. It had the same energy as Roots. It was Roots for the 21st century. Thanks to advances in DNA analysis, a journey that once took 12 years, that's how long Alex had spent working on his book, could now be traversed in a matter of hours or days. When he was on his long and lonely journey, he could not have imagined that he was walking around with the secret to his genealogical identity written in his genome. It turns out we just had to turn inward instead of standing at the Statue of Liberty and trying to figure out which way Africa sits far across the ocean. So how would Alex Haley, who died in 1992, feel about this revolutionary technology? I think he would have greeted it with glee. He was a good and generous man. He was a profound humanist. He had a lot of light in his eyes. I met him only in a couple of times, but I'll never forget what an honor it was. And he loved learning. With Roots, I think he followed all the clues as diligently as he could, and he reached his conclusions in good faith. Many scholars have questioned his research since the book was published, but its importance as a phenomenon lay beyond its quote-unquote historical accuracy. The book is a landmark in American history, a signal accomplishment as a profound act of the imagination. Roots continue to be important because we are a nation of immigrants. Even Native Americans came here from somewhere else. They walked across the Bering Strait some 15,000 years ago. Our African ancestors, of course, did not emigrate here willingly. After all, none of our ancestors arrived on the Mayflower. And as enslaved human beings, they were unwilling immigrants, but immigrants nonetheless. That's one of the recurring truths in Finding Your Roots. And think it was also the message of Alec Haley's Roots. African Americans are immigrants, too. We have ancestors with names and birth dates tracing deep into the American past. names and date that slavery sought to rob. And now the tools exist to help us find them. And through our DNA, we can begin to understand the depth and complexity, not only of our African ethnic roots, but of our European and Native American roots as well. Alex Haley stood on the shoulders of Frederick Douglass, who searched so desperately for his roots until the very end of his life. And today, all of us who embark on the exhilarating path in search of our roots stand on the shoulders of an intrepid author named Alex Haley. Henry Louis Skip Gates, Jr. is an American literary critic, professor, historian, and filmmaker. He serves as the Alphonse Fletcher University Professor and Director of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University, as the host of Finding Your Roots on PBS, which is a fascinating show. And this is a quote from Alex Haley. In my long and troubled journey to complete Roots, I know an undying depth to Reader's Digest. Without its help and encouragement, Roots could not have been written with the scope that it has. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. That was an interesting article. And there's a picture that I'm looking at on this particular article. It's a double-page spread, and it shows hundreds, I mean hundreds, maybe even thousands, of chickens getting ready to be harvested. Mass production. Workers process about 200,000 birds per day at a Costco meat processing plant in Nebraska. Is Costco chicken good for you? Americans love the company's rotisserie chicken, but there are concerns about how birds sold there and elsewhere are raised. Here's what you need to know. This also applies to BJ's and Sam's Club as well. Costco's rotisserie chickens are a phenomenon. Sold under the franchise brand's name, Kirkland Signature, the chickens are super tasty, super popular, and super cheap. At just $5, they can be less expensive than a whole uncooked bird. But they're also the focus of controversy. In 2020, the animal rights group Mercy for Animals sent an undercover investigator to work at and film inside one of Costco's factory chicken farms in Nebraska. The resulting video, released in February 2021, showed swollen, injured, and deformed chickens living in a crowded, darkened warehouse. It was the subject of a New York Times opinion piece and has become part of an initiative by Mercy for Animals called Costco Exposed. Since then, Mercy for Animals has pressured Costco to sign the Better Chicken Commitment, a petition from the organization and several other animal rights groups. It urges the poultry industry to change how it raises its birds, improving their welfare as well as the safety of the meat that's sold. While more than 200 companies, including Whole Foods, BJ's, Burger King, Chipotle, and Subway, have signed on to that commitment, Costco and other major chicken producers have not. A Costco spokesperson told Consumer Reports that the company has no current plan to adopt in total the requirements of the Better Chicken Commitment, but added that its internal standards for our dedicated producers enforce appropriate requirements for broiler welfare. Here's what you need to know about how Costco raises its birds. We also have information about other chickens the company sells, as well as alternatives from other retailers. Rotisserie birds equal salty birds. Although Costco's whole roasted rotisserie chicken has become famous because of its convenience, flavor, and low price, it isn't unique. Other chains also sell inexpensive rotisserie chicken. For instance, ShopRite offers toasted broiler from one of its house brands, Bowl and Basket, listed for $5.99 online. While rotisserie chickens are convenient and easy on your wallet, they're not necessarily so good for your health. That's because they can be loaded with salt and sugar solution to enhance flavor and tenderness. Costco's rotisserie chicken has 460 milligrams of sodium per standard 3-ounce serving, one-fifth of the maximum amount adults should consume in a day. 2,300 milligrams. ShopRite's Bowl and Basket chicken has even more, 520 milligrams per 3-ounce serving. Many people eat more than that amount and get even more sodium. So check the nutrition label before buying a rotisserie chicken and avoid those that are flavored because they tend to be salter, says Amy Keaton, RD, Consumer Reports resident nutritionist. Instead, choose one that's simply roasted chicken. A better option, of course, is cook your own. Of course, people buy rotisserie chickens when they don't want to cook at home. But Keating says a roast chicken can be simple to prepare once you get your recipe down. It can be healthier, too. You can roast your own, even using a multi-cooker, grill, or convection toaster oven, she says. But skip the salt or use just a touch, and season it with a variety of dried herbs and spices, such as pepper, thyme, rosemary sage, and garlic powder. For extra flavor, you can put several garlic cloves and a lemon slice in quarters in the cavity of the bird. The problem with factory farming. Costco also sells uncooked chicken under its Kirkland Signature brand, similar to the birds it uses for rotisserie version. Most of the estimated 9 billion chickens raised in the U.S. each year by Costco and other chicken producers are housed on factory farms in windowless buildings with tens of thousands of other birds. The crowded conditions have an impact on animal welfare and can foster the spread of dangerous bacteria such as Salmonella and Campylobacter, which are particularly prevalent in chicken. A better option. Choose organic. Costco carries a Kirkland Signature organic whole chicken. You'll pay more for it, $2.49 per pound at a Costco in Metro New York in early November, compared with 99 cents a pound for the company's conventionally raised bird. But that's less on average than what chickens cost at grocery stores nationwide, $3.12 per pound for organic and $1.09 per pound for conventional. Chickens bearing the USDA organic label differ from conventionally raised birds in several important ways. First, they must be raised without any antibiotics. Conventionally raised birds, on the other hand, can be given antibiotics before they get sick to ward off disease, a practice that reduces the effectiveness of those antibiotics over time and can lead to widespread antibiotic resistance. Note, though, that if organic chickens do become ill and need antibiotics, organic regulations require that the animals be treated, but their meat can't be sold as organic. In addition, chickens with organic label must be fed organic feed, which means it was produced without pesticides or genetically modified seed. Last, any chicken bearing the USDA organic label is supposed to be raised in slightly more humane conditions. Costco spokesperson said the company adheres to the Department of Agriculture's standard for organic birds, meaning they live in less crowded conditions than conventionally raised chicken, and that organically raised chickens have access to outdoors. Indeed, the USDA standard for organic chickens stipulate that they should be provided exposure to sunlight, fresh air, shade, and exercise areas. What does humanely raised mean? Chicken labels often bear claims that relate to how the birds were raised, but humane treatment means different things to different groups and may not match what you'd expect. CR surveys show that many people, such labels indicate a minimum that animals were raised in living conditions that allowed them to engage in their natural behaviors, such as scratching and pecking. CR rated several labels on how well they meet those expectations. Note that the score for animal welfare shown below rates to chicken raised for meat. For more information, go to cr.org/foodlabels0122. USDA Organic. Overall score was a big double green. Animal welfare was an orange drop. Overall, this is one of the most meaningful labels a food can carry, indicating that producers adhere to strict federal standards requiring, for example, that animals be raised without antibiotics. But it falls short as far as animal welfare is concerned, mainly because the Department of Agriculture hasn't enforced rules on outdoor access. Animal welfare approved. Overall score is a double green. Animal welfare is a double green. Standards for this seal are set by a nonprofit group, A Greener World. Chickens must have access to the outdoors and be pasture-raised on family farms, meaning the farmer owns the animals. Painful procedures such as beak trimming are forbidden, and birds must be stunned before slaughter. Certified humane, raised and handled. That also has a green score, but not quite as good as animal welfare. Humane Farm Animal Care, a nonprofit, oversees this seal. Outdoor access isn't required, but birds are given slightly more room than the industry norm, and living conditions are carefully controlled. An animal welfare officer must oversee slaughter to ensure that proper procedures are followed. And the final one is American Humane Certified. Overall score is kind of neutral. Under this seal from the nonprofit American Humane Association, outdoor access isn't required and indoor space can be minimal. Birds must be given at least 4 hours of a continual darkness, which is more than required, but less than what some other animal welfare programs ask for. Confessions of a Costco Virgin. I didn't think warehouse club culture was for me. Could the lure of its rotisserie chicken broaden my horizon? This is by Brian Vaines, who's a young black man. Somehow I'd managed to reach the ripe old age of 40 and never had been inside a Costco, the world's third largest retailer. But my colleagues at CR were determined to change that. They said they would pay for my membership if I agreed to check out the place and write about it. They talked up the deals and the quality of the products on offer. "You gotta try the rotisserie chicken at least once," they all said. Still, I was hesitant. Like many other urban hipster transplants with big city zip codes and flyover routes, I have neither a car nor a pantry. A warehouse club membership seemed like part of the deal you make with the devil when you trade bike riding and bodegas for the comfort of a den in a basement deep freezer. I love a bargain, but worried about dancing on the edge of the slippery slope of the suburbs. Not only that, I wasn't much of a meat eater. Before base mask and working from home, I had a primarily plant-based diet. Aside from my boiled egg breakfast and sardines and greens daily lunch, it was a meatless Monday for me every day for a decade. But the pandemic changed a lot, including my eating habits, and those famed Costco chickens were starting to sound tempting. I only half-jokingly thought that whatever people were shopping for at Costco, be it a hearing aid or a 93-inch teddy bear, they probably don't leave without a bird. So when I arrived at Costco warehouse number 318 in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, I expected to be greeted at the door by an industrial-sized rotisserie filled with chickens swirling their way to golden brown perfection. In reality, I had to walk past big screen TVs, mattresses, and more bottled water than I ever seen in one place. I even got a whiff of those chickens. And when I approached the bank of well-cooked and oddly uniformed birds in their black-bottomed to-go containers, I realized I had a lot more stores to explore before I committed to loading one of them into my cart. My rejections at the birds at hand led me to a bird and a half in the proverbial bush. Not only that far away stood an open refrigerator case, stocked with ready-to-cook herbed buttered salmon fillets, plus, big happy surprise, chilled rotisserie chickens. They were split into halves, packaged three to a container for $1 more than a freshly cooked whole bird. Why do the hot ones get all the love when these guys almost guarantee dinner and several days' lunch? Reader, it reheated beautifully. So now that I've tasted the delights of Costco's rotisserie chickens, am I consigned to a life of khaki pants and lawn maintenance? First off, I don't have a lawn. And second, shopping at Costco is no more likely to transform me into my dad than his wearing skinny jeans would turn him into me. Still, while I can't imagine the folks at the warehouse will be learning my name anytime soon, they will be seeing me from time to time, at least as long as they keep selling that cold rotisserie chicken for just $5.99. That was a cute article. Okay, let's continue on with the regular article here. Still, there are limitations when it comes to animal welfare with the USDA organic label. It gets only a fair rating in CR's food label analysis on that measure. For instance, while the chickens are supposed to have access to the outdoors, the USDA hasn't enforced that requirement. Further, the organic label doesn't prohibit farmers from making physical alterations to the animals, such as trimming the chickens' beaks, which doesn't cover animal welfare requirements en route to the slaughterhouse or while there. How to find a humanely raised bird? If you're particularly concerned about animal welfare, look for chickens sold with either the Certified Humane Raised and Handled label or the Animal Welfare Approved label. CR rates the Certified Humane Raised and Handled label as very good when it comes to the welfare of poultry raised for meat. Although outdoor access isn't required, the birds are given slightly more room than the industry norm. Plus, the litter in the chicken house must be kept clean and birds must be given environmental enrichment, like straw bales, to keep them active. The standard also dictates that farmers aren't allowed to leave the lights on continuously in the chicken houses, a practice that prevents birds from sleeping so that it can eat more and grow faster, a major animal welfare concern. Last, a company-appointed animal welfare officer must be at the slaughterhouse to ensure that the birds are stunned adequately before being killed to reduce suffering. You can find retailers that carry these birds at certifiedhumane.org. Birds with animal welfare-approved seal can be even better option because requirements for that seal are even more demanding. It's rated excellent for animal welfare by CR's food analysts. You can find retailers that sell the birds at agreenerworld.org. Birds sold with that label must be raised in a pasture rather than in close confinement. If chicken houses are used at all, ventilation and natural light are required, and, as required for the Certified Humane and Raised Handled label, the lights can't be left on continuously. Further, this seal indicates that painful procedures such as beak trimming are prohibited. Last, the Animal Welfare Approved label means the chickens were gently handled and properly stunned during the slaughtering process. You can also purchase chicken from a local farmer or farmer's market, or you can ask about farmer prices. The safest way to prepare chicken. Whichever type of chicken you choose, always practice rigorous hygiene. Even pre-cooked rotisserie chickens can be inadvertently contaminated with germs. Here's how to stay safe. Cook or reheat your chicken to an internal temperature of 165 degrees Fahrenheit. That kills any bacteria before you dig in to eat. Wash your hands well with soap and water before and after handling raw chicken. Considering using separate cutting boards and utensils for meat and produce so that you don't spread bacteria from the meat to vegetables or fruit. Never rest a raw chicken in a sink. That spreads bacteria in the sink and the surrounding countertops. There's no need to rinse or clean chicken. Always use a clean plate to serve cooked meat. Don't reuse the same one you used to prepare the raw chicken. That makes sense. Chicken rotisserie FAQs. When is the best to buy one? Buy one that's been cooked recently. You're most likely to get freshly cooked bird around the evening rush hour, because that's when most places pick up production, says Anne-Marie Roenick, founder and grocery market analyst firm 210 Analytics. Are rotisserie chickens made from raw birds sold at the store near their sell-by date? Nope. Most grocery stores have a different supply for their rotisserie chickens than what they sell in their meat departments, Roenick says. Unsold rotisserie chickens, on the other hand, may be used to make chicken soup or chicken salad at the store. Why do the rotisserie chickens sometimes look pink inside? Probably not because they're undercooked. Instead, there can be more pigmentation in and around the bones of the smaller, younger birds often used for rotisserie chickens. How long can you keep a rotisserie chicken? Cut into several pieces and refrigerate in a covered container for up to 4 days or freeze it. Frozen leftovers are safe indefinitely, but best eaten within 4 months, after which moisture and flavor are compromised. Okay, this is kind of weird. The next article I was going to read, for a better night's sleep, try this. However, I have already received next month's Consumer Reports, and the theme for that is how to get the sleep you need. So I think what I'm going to do is skip this particular article until next week or when I finish this particular Consumer Reports, and we'll come back to it when we get to the other article so we can double up on the two together. Okay, road report. Cold weather tire safety. Kind of fits this time of year, doesn't it? If you see tire pressure warning on your dashboard this season, you might not have a leak or a flat. It could be just the weather. Tire pressure drops along with the mercury about 1 pound per square inch for every 10 degree Fahrenheit drop in air temperature. The warning light may go off while you're driving and the air in the tire expands. But check the pressure and top off the tire if necessary as soon as possible. In general, check the pressure monthly and don't wait for the warning light to come on. It's meant to alert you to a tire losing air while you're driving, not serve as a maintenance reminder. What is a turbocharged engine? We see a lot of these nowadays. Turbocharging, forcing more air into the engine so that it burns more fuel, enables a small, fuel-efficient four-cylinder produce V6 power when needed. But there can be a trade-off, such as a vehicle need for premium gasoline. And CR surveys have found that manufacturers that have been building turbocharged engines for several years tend to have more reliable powertrains than manufacturers that have produced these engines more recently. Always check CR's reliability ratings before buying a new or used vehicle. The vital statistic, 18.4%. Estimated year-over increase in deaths due to vehicle crashes in the first half of 2021. The steepest such rise since 2006. Precise causes aren't known yet, but speeding and a failure to wear seatbelts were also elevated during that time, compared with before the pandemic. And we have a recall on Volvos. Volvo is recalling 194,500 V70 and X70 wagons from model years 2001 through 2007. A component in the driver's side airbag could rupture and launch metal fragments toward occupants that the airbag deploys, potentially causing injury or death. This expands an earlier recall of more than 260,000 S60 and S80 Dans for the same reason. Volvo will replace the faulty airbag free of charge. Owners may contact Volvo customer service at 1-800-458-1552. Building a better world together. More accessible broadband. Internet access has become a vital necessity, almost as essential to our lives as utilities like water and electricity. Yet far too many of us either lack access to broadband or struggle to afford it. Almost a quarter of households are not connected to the Internet via broadband, according to a June 21st nationally representative CR survey of 2,565 U.S. adults. 32% of them because it costs too much, 25% because it's not available in their area. Of those who do have broadband, 24% say it's difficult to afford. CR has long urged policymakers to address these problems, and our efforts are now bearing fruit. The federal infrastructure bill signed into law in November includes $65 billion for new broadband access and affordability initiatives, many of which CR has long championed. Some $4.25 billion would go to building out broadband infrastructure with a focus on underserved markets. In addition, $14.2 billion will extend subsidies and created in response to the pandemic to help low-income families afford high-speed Internet. The law will also require providers to start using a standardized format to describe their service, offerings, and prices. Modeled on food nutrition labels, they'll help consumers understand exactly what they'll get for their money and enable them to comparison shop for providers and services plans. Call to action. A recent CR investigation found that almost a third of popular spices and herbs, 40 of the 126 products we tested, contained concerning levels of heavy metals in most of those products. The amount of arsenic, lead, and cadmium combined poses a health risk for anyone regularly consuming them in typical serving sizes. In children, exposure can affect the brain development. In adults, it can contribute to central nervous system and reproductive problems and can damage kidney and immune function. Help us urge the Food and Drug Administration to set stricter limits on heavy metals and in foods by signing our petition at cr.org/spices0222. Reducing antibiotic use. Antibiotic drugs are gradually becoming less effective at treating human illnesses. One reason is that many industrial farms overuse antibiotics in animals, often to prevent diseases caused by overcrowded and unsanitary living conditions. Such unnecessary use creates more opportunities for microbes to evolve, rendering antibiotics less effective. This also leads to drug-resistant strains of bacteria, such as Salmonella and Campylobacter, which are commonly spread by food animals. More than 35,000 people die each year from antibiotic-resistant infections, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2018, McDonald's, the nation's largest purchaser of beef, committed to reducing the amount of antibiotics it uses in raising its beef. At the time, CR and other consumer groups applauded the announcement, but the fast food giant has missed its own deadline for announcing reduction targets. How CR has your back? CR spent years putting a spotlight on this problem and promoting good stewardships of antibiotics by encouraging their use only for people and animals who need them to treat a diagnosed illness. Now we are organizing consumers to send messages directly to McDonald's CEO and board of directors to let them know what action an antibiotic reduction is overdue. Join us in telling McDonald's to live up to its commitment by reducing use of medically important antibiotics in its supply chain. You can find the CR petition at cr.org/antibiotics0222. Ask the experts. When filling my gas tank, I sometimes top it off after the fuel pump automatically shuts off. Is this safe to do? It's not uncommon for drivers to keep going after the pump clicks off to round up the dollar amounts for the sale. But this is a potentially dangerous habit that could end up costing you, our experts caution. This practice can damage the onboard refueling vapor recovery, ORVR, system, a charcoal canister that collects potentially harmful fuel vapors by saturating with fuel. When damaged, it might not do its job of collecting those vapors, emitting them into the outside air instead, triggering the check engine light to go on. Repairing the ORVR system can cost hundreds of dollars, money you'll be spending on a part that otherwise should last the entire life of your vehicle. Additionally, when you overfill your tank, the likelihood that you'll spill a few drops of grass on the ground near the pump increases. That's a potential fire safety hazard, as well as an environmental one. Should I buy an air fryer, or can I get similar results using my regular oven? If you have a convection oven or a convection toaster oven, you can mimic the crispy fried texture that an air fryer provides, also without using a lot of oil to do it. That's because the convection setting, in which hot air is constantly circulated using one or more fans, employs the same technology as countertop air fryers. In fact, some full-size ovens and newer toaster ovens even have a dedicated air fry setting. To see how well these work, we made batches of frozen fries in a few full-size convection ovens, as well as in two convection toaster ovens. Even without using any oil, our full-size ovens turned out nicely golden fries, albeit not as quite as beautifully brown as when we cooked them at a countertop air fryer. The often small capacity of standalone air fryers lets hot air circulate around food quickly, plus some offer basket-style accessories for better browning. But a full-sized oven has the benefits of holding much more food. As for the toaster ovens, a Breville model we tried outperformed a competitor from Cuisinart, delivering crispy golden food. If you have a convection oven or a toaster oven that doesn't have an air fryer setting, look for a convection roast or bake setting, or use a dark sheet pan, these heat up faster than light-colored ones. To get the crispy results, I advise a Teresa Laguerra, CR's test engineer in charge of ranges, cooktops, and wall ovens. I have an Android phone. Is it possible to video chat with friends who have iPhones? There are plenty of video chat apps you can use to keep in touch with friends and family members. but it can be tricky to find the best option when Android users seek to connect with those who use Apple devices, says CR Tech editor Nicholas DeLeon. One option is to use Apple's well-known video chat app, FaceTime, but the Apple user needs to be the one to initiate the call. Just open the FaceTime app, create link, and then follow prompts to share the link with an Android user via text or email. When an Android user clicks the FaceTime link, they'll be prompted to join the video call. One method for Android users to initiate video calls to those with iPhones may be to employ the Google Duo app, which comes standard in most Android phones and is also available in the Apple's App Store. Google Duo lets you video chat with up to 32 people, and anyone in the app can initiate the call. If the person doesn't pick up, you can even leave a quick video message. Another option, you can both download an app such as Skype or Signal, which allows any party to initiate or receive a video call. All the apps listed above, including FaceTime, use end-to-end encryption, which is designed to protect your personal data from digital snoops. In the know, great gift baskets for less. The website photos of gift baskets always look so tempting. Delicious fruits and chocolates, cheeses and gourmet popcorn, all of them wrapped to perfection in beautiful containers. But just how closely will the basket you've ordered for a friend or colleague actually resemble what's pictured online? To find out, we asked 25 CR staffers to purchase gift baskets for coworkers from several popular gifting websites. Each basket or box cost about $100 before taxes and shipping fees, and senders noted the variety of options and ease of ordering when the gift packages arrived. We then asked the recipients how satisfied we were with the gift basket or box. We also asked the recipients to share photos of their gifts with their senders so they could also score how happy they were with what they'd ordered. None of the gifts arrived looking exactly like the highly styled images on the website, but nearly all senders thought that the gifts they sent were pretty close match to what they've shown online. Mouth, the top-ranking company, got high scores for satisfaction from its gift basket senders and receivers. Knack, like Mouth, let users customize what's in their packages and received high marks for recipient satisfaction. Olive and Coco also got some raves from recipients. One called their box elegant and sophisticated. Harry and David, perhaps the most well-known gift basket company tried, got the lowest score. Our staffers reported three separate instances of receiving damaged pears. A few people felt Harry and David didn't pack enough in his baskets, given the price. So then there's a picture of these things, and the one from Olive and Coco shows guts a okay on order, 3 out of 5 on ordering, a 5 out of 5 on recipient satisfaction, a 3 out of 5 on center satisfaction. It includes buffalo chips, Olive and Coco popcorn, looks like a nut mix, has crackers, has vole pie, looks like it says corn and black silk salsa. The most satisfying and nice selection of gifts was Mouth. Got 4 out of 5 for ordering, 4 out of 5 for recipient satisfaction, and 4 out of 5 for sender satisfaction. It looks like jarred things, jams and stuff. Great do-it-yourself gift options are Knack. 4 out of 5 out of ordering, 5 out of 5 out of recipient satisfaction, and 3 out of 5 out of sender satisfaction. And it includes everything from chocolates, crackers, looks like a nut combination, and some other kind of things that I can't. Oh, looks like maybe some meat snacks. Good variety, but some fruit arrived damaged, was Harry and David. 3 out of 5 for ordering, 4 out of 5 by recipient satisfaction, and 3 out of 5 for sender satisfaction. So that didn't really get that good of a score. Now, I've never thought of this as something really you'd be really anxious about, just I just buy what I needed. Sheet pans you'll love. A sheet pan is a staple in any kitchen, but an inferior one can leave you with unevenly cooked food and nearly impossible to clean. So in our search for the perfect sheet pan, we put 19 of them in the test. We loaded up each one with neat rows of sugar cookies to assess how evenly the pans baked both the bottoms and the tops. Then we evaluated how each sheet pan handled a complete dinner of chicken thighs, potatoes, onions, carrots, and celery. Finally, we checked to see how easy each pan was to clean and performed abrasion tests on the pans to gauge the durability of their top surfaces. In the end, we found a few new near-perfect pans and noted some key differences between the non-stick coated pans and the uncoated pans we tested. Coated pans tend to heat up and cook food faster, says Bertie Dietrich, the CR engineer who conducted our test, but the uncoated pans tend to bake more evenly and are more durable over time. The top uncoated pan, but heavy, weighs 3 pounds, is all-clad D3 stainless jelly roll pan for $150. $150 for a sheet pan? Wow. 5 out of 5 for evenness, 5 out of 5 for durability, and 2 out of 5 for cleaning. Best value and lightweight. Amazon Commercial Aluminum Baking Half Sheet 2-Pack, $25. 5 out of 5 for evenness, 5 out of 5 for durability, and 2 out of 5 for cleaning. Best nonstick and easy to clean is the Williams-Sonoma Gold Touch Pro Nonstick Corrugated Half Sheet at $33. That overall score was 4.5 for evenness, 3.5 for durability, and 5.5 for cleaning. Bargain Durable Nonstick. Mainstays from Walmart, gold non-stick aluminized half sheet for $8. Now that's what I'd go for. 4 out of 5 for evenness, 4 out of 5 for durability, and 4 out of 5 for cleaning. I'm sorry, I just can't imagine spending $150 for a doggone sheet pan. Most reliable heating systems. Our recent survey of consumer-owned heating systems, we asked CR members how long they expected their systems, natural gas furnaces, boilers, or heat pumps, to last. Owners of heat pumps reported immediate life expectancy of 15 years, and those who owned gas furnaces or boilers said they were hoping for about 20 years. But on average, our analysis of the survey found that all three types of heating systems are likely to experience a breakdown halfway through that life expectancy, at 8 years for heat pumps and 10 for gas furnaces and boilers. The good news, CR's members who paid for repairs out of pocket reported them cost between $300 and $400, no matter which system they had. That's thousands of dollars less than buying a new system, so it's often worth attempting a repair first. When you do need to buy a new system, you want one that lasts, you know, and most of the least reliable brands from our survey. The gas furnaces Payne and Train got the best. Coleman, Luxair, York, Rigidaire, Maytag, and White Westinghouse, so-so gas furnaces. Boilers Burnham, Crown, and Lennox got the best scores. Dunkirk and Utica boilers, so-so. Heat pumps American Standard and Train got 5s out of 5. Frigidaire, Maytag, and White Westinghouse were just so-so. And with that, with a couple times, a little bit of time for quotable quotes. Power is holding someone else's fear in your hand and show it to them, Amy Tan. Humor plays close to the big hot fire, which is truth, E.B. White, a writer. A gentleman will not insult me, and no man, not a gentleman, can insult me, Frederick Douglass, an abolitionist. Happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length, from Robert Frost. See everything, overlook a great deal, correct a little, Pope John the 23rd. The way you overcome shyness is become so wrapped in something that you forget to be afraid, Lady Bird Johnson. Exhaust the little moment, soon it dies, and be it a gash or gold, it will not come again in this identical disguise, Gwendolyn Brooks. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time.